This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us...
Colin Crooks.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Colin, we were talking about dolme, or you were telling us about your experience with doll making and the classes you gave and the competitions and all the participation. There's a lot more to say about this in terms of the actual work with the dolls, because in the last time we were talking, you were describing the porcelain and making all the pieces and some of the painting. But once you've got the basic porcelain doll together, what
right, well, that's when the fun begins, or the headaches, because then we have to dress the doll. Now, depending on the dolly, whether it's a German or a French doll, or a baby doll, or a toddler, a lady doll, as to what style you're going to dress it in. Now, we're very much purists when it comes to dressing our antique dolls.
Okay, now you are saying German or French. Are those the only...
Pretty much. There was another factory that made moulds for dolls, which were Nippon, which were Japanese. But we tend not to try and recreate them, because they were really very basic in their sculpturing and things like that. So we tend to just keep to the French and German.
Okay,
so, and once again, depending on which one we're dressing, as to what style and to what sort of fabric. Now, because, as I say, we are purists, we like to only use man-made fibres, like cotton and linen and silk.
Nothing. Because those are the ones the factories used.
And those were the only ones that were available. There was no polyesters, no synthetics. And so we are so true to our craft that we don't have a piece of nylon in the studio, but we try not to. So the hunt for these pure fabrics is really part of the challenge. And so we visit op shops and second-hand shops and be very friendly to older people who might have something stashed in their cupboards and drawers. And we've been very lucky, and it's such a great thrill to find the very right piece of fabric or the very right colour that you're looking for. Colours are important too, because they didn't really have a lot of pastels. They had, the Germans had quite vibrant colours. They used oranges and reds, but most of their toddler dolls and baby dolls were dressed in white. Beautiful white with a lot of hand embroidery.
But would they fade, or if their colours, or would they?
Oh, they did. They did. They faded. You just didn't put Dolly in the sunlight. But
So when you've made them, you've got to keep them in special cabinets or something.
People do. Barbara does. I tend to have mine scattered around the place a bit, because I'm forever having to get them to show people, this is what I want, this is... mine haven't got... They're not in the same spot for too long, poor things. They get carried around and put in different places. But most people do keep them under glass and things like that.
So just write that. Roughly, how many dolls would you have?
I don't really know, Stuart, but several hundred.
Several hundred,
okay. I would think. Now, the thing is about a doll collection, they can overwhelm people's houses. And I tried very hard not for it to overwhelm my house where my children were growing up and my dear husband was alive.
So how long have you been doing this?
Oh, long time. 30, 40 years, I don't know. Okay. So anyway, so all the dolls, I was lucky. My husband really encouraged me with my doll making. He was so good that I couldn't take advantage of his goodness by having a whole lot of dolls in the bedroom. So I had a separate house on the property. A sort of a big flat, if you like.
You called it a doll's house, but it was full size.
Yeah, full size. And it was purpose-built for grandparents that would be living okay. there, but I took it over when it was needed for that for my dolly. So I had a huge big studio and rooms full of dolls, and it was great. But after my husband died, I had to downsize and sell and come to a smaller place, and now everything is compacted quite tightly. And now I do have dolls in the bedroom and every other room. And I have a dolls hospital inside as well as the workshop outside.
Dolls, that's for repairing other people's dolls.
Yes, so. Yeah, and I bring them inside to repair. And then I have...
You've just turned 80.
I have, you? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yet you're still over. You're giving classes in doll making. You have a hospital for dolls.
Right.
You're teaching, and you're still very active.
Very active. And I travel. Okay. But that's the big thing. To see my children and grandchildren. So, no, I'm very active. My doctor thinks I'm fantastic.
Well, I think it's the mental and physical things of making dolls that keeps you young.
Well, I think if you're passionate about anything, whether it's planting pansies in a garden, you know, it doesn't matter. You've got to be really passionate about it. And
is
I love
it a very expensive hobby then? Or is it a hobby or a business?
It's a hobby. It's a hobby that's growing like Topsy. Yes, so you have to, my accountant tells me it's still a hobby, all right?
Do you have an accountant for your doll making business?
Well, it was for my husband's business, and he used to take my books in as an overflow, and he just said it's a hobby because you're not making any money at this. Okay. But it can be expensive. Can't it, Barbara? It can be. But I try and not let it be too expensive. I try to think of ways that they can do things without it costing them too much money. Yep. They do have to pay for coming to class because I provide, apart from my expertise, I provide things that they
need.
Well,
you do the kiln firing and
the paint.
Now, the issue of dressing these dolls, then the purest, you're looking for the designs, the right material, you're trying to follow. Is there much creativity? Do people I'll do that my own designs and so on? Are there competition for that as well, or it's more following the authentic?
Well, there's two schools of thought there, Stuart. If you're creating a reproduction of an antique, you have to be pretty true to what the master wanted. Saying that, you might look at what he's done and think, well, I can do something much nicer than that, and you can do that, and if the judge can see where you're going with it, well done. But if it's a modern doll, there's no really master plan about it, and you can please yourself. And so a lot of people prefer to do that. They don't like having to be controlled with an antique. Most of my students, 90% of my students, prefer to do antiques because they're really skillful, my students, and they've got the skill to do them.
So what is the... I'm thinking of my involvement with pottery. Are they coming along with the idea, I want to make a doll, and that's it, and then finish?
Very seldom that happens. They might come along and say, I want to make a doll for my little girl or granddaughter or something. Before they've painted the first eyelash, they're saying to me, now the next doll I'm going to make is, they've already decided on their next doll and their next doll. Now, some of my students have been with me for 30 years and they've never left, and they've made every doll I've got. And I say to them, don't you think you should move on? and there's no way they're ever going to move on. They said, no, we belong to you. It's the sisterhood of a whole lot of women sitting around a table sharing everything that goes on in their lives and knowing it's probably, hopefully, going to stay in the studio. We don't talk about it outside the studio. I call it a sisterhood, and I think that's a good word for it. But even when we had guys in the cast, when James was there, we still managed to have a conversation that James could join in. So, and he relished it, I think.
Are you saying the conversation would be quite different if James wasn't there?
I don't know, because I have a few rules. There's a few things they're not allowed to talk about. And occasionally it does overflow.
It's a good social environment.
It is. But I don't like them talking about politics and religion and things like that because everyone's got their own opinion. And we're a nice bunch of women. I don't want them to argue, you know. They can do it outside, but when they were doing Dolly's, we just have a lot of laughs about everyday things, really. Yeah. And we discuss American politics or other countries' politics. But it's good, isn't it? What do you think, Barbara?
Very good social.
And we've helped women through all sorts of trauma in their lives, and they've helped me when I've had sadness in my life, and they're just great.
So is there more to say about dressing these doctors? It's not just an outer layer that you're
doing. No, the thing I'd like to say mostly about the dressing is the underwear. We are allowed to talk about underwear.
And this is all historically accurate.
This is very historically accurate because in 1820, up until 1820, females didn't wear knickers. I don't know whether you knew that.
Well, do you do men in kilts?
Yes, Barbara does.
Yeah.
Kilts.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And they have underwear.
Mm. Mm. But that's not authentic.
We won't.
They do have underwear.
My son's a piper and he wears underwear.
Okay.
But anyway, the woman didn't wear... I'm talking about German and French women at this stage. They didn't wear until about the 1820s. And the first race of people that wore underwear were German women. Mostly they were more like huge, big bloomers that they wore. Then the French woman with their crinolines...
Crinoline
are those big skirts that come right out like this.
Okay.
And they were talked into wearing drawers.
And drawers are... What's the difference between drawers and bloomers?
Bloomers are voluminous. They just go out...
Really baggy, loose-fitting.
Very, very, not very sexy-looking piece of underwear. Mm. Whereas the French woman had split drawers. Now, a split drawer is for a reason. And the reason being, I'll quickly go on to this reason, in case you're wondering where I'm going with this, is because of the crinoline gowns. Now, the crinoline gowns were too big to get through doorways. So the woman that wore them had chambermaids.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the chambermaid's job... was when the lady needed to visit the little girl's room, she couldn't because her skirts were too wide.
Could she get through any doorway?
Only great big double doors, I think. I wasn't there at the time.
Yeah.
So the chambermaid would put the chamber on a little trolley and wheel it underneath the skirt of the crinoline. Yeah. And that's where the split drawers came in handy.
Okay.
So there was no having to pull up and pull down. I don't know whether you want to include that, but I just thought it was a little bit of...
No elastic either back then.
No, and there was no elastic during the war either because all the rubber was used for other things, so they used buttons, and the buttons were mostly honed from bone and something else, which I just can't think of at the moment, because today buttons are all plastic and things like that.
Yeah. So, mind you, when elastic in the years after the the Second World War. I remember at school in the 1950s, the school principal would always have a big supply of girls' underwear because the elastic kept failing. And anyway, this is moving a long way from the topic of dolls, but
if you're doing a French doll, you'd make split drawers because that's what they wore in those days.
Okay.
Right up until, I don't know, they might still, I don't know. I don't know many French people really, so I don't know. Anyway, so then they'd have their split drawers. Then they would have a corset. Even little girls wore corsets. And over top of the corset would be a corset cover, and over top of that would be a chemise, and then they'd have at least two petticoats. Now, it can take you weeks and weeks and weeks to make underwear for a doll. And if you're being really, really true, the corsets would have little whale bones in them. You can't get whale bones today, but if you hunt around, you can get little wee bones. They're metal bones, purpose-built for corsets. I don't think women wear them today, but in second-hand shops you can still find little metal bones.
You mean from life-size corsets for people, and you cut them down
if you're being really true, but I don't think I've ever actually done that. So that's the underwear. It can take weeks and weeks and weeks, and it's usually exquisite because my ladies all do a lot of beautiful embroidery, and they collect lovely lace, and it's just exquisite. And then we have to do the top layer, and that's also exquisite, and every stitch has to be perfect. You can't put a foot wrong.
Are there just a few standards? Can you machine do it?
You can, and you can do straight seams with the machine, but some of the joy is the hand sewing on it, and I particularly like doing the hand sewing. I'd rather hand sew than machine sew. And I always have a little bundle next to me over on the couch there where I do hand sewing, and you do too, Barbara, don't you? Yeah, we much prefer it. And it's easier for little dolls, really, too. And then we have the joy of shoes and socks. Now we have to make our own shoes. So you have to be a bit of a cobbler. You have to make your own hats. So you have to be a milliner.
So you're banging really small nails into...
Not really. We do a little bit of gluing with the shoes.
Yeah,
you can...
Okay. What do you use to make the shoes, then?
Leather. All sorts of leather, like glove leather.
You'd need something really thin one.
Yeah, the glove leather is really good.
Okay.
But might be a little bit too thin for a bigger doll. So we're a bit selective when it comes to leather.
So how do you get it? You buy it as sheets of leather?
But people are pretty clever at finding slink factories and places like that where there's leather.
And
you can cut up an old handbag. You know, there's all sorts of ways of doing it. And the hats are great fun. I love making hats. You can make hats out of feathers and all sorts of things. Now, the hair, I didn't tell you about the hair. Now, the hair was traditionally... mohair.
I can see on some of these dolls
it's painted.
It's part of the mold. Firing. In the mold you have hair and then you just paint it.
Yeah.
But there's one doll I can see here with very wavy, light brown hair that's...
Mohair. No,
that's mohair?
That's mohair. Now, there's a long process in making a wig. Now, you can buy a store-bought wig, but what's the joy in that when you can make a wig? Now, how do we procure the mohair? Lots of different ways. You can wander and ramble around fields and pluck bits of mohair off barbed wire fences. What fun. Or you can buy it from a mohair farm type place. And then you have to weft it and clean it and dye it. And
so
make
weft
a wig.
It and clean.
Yeah, because
wefting is that sort of comb-y?
Yes, thing, yes, okay. Yeah. And then sewing it in long strips, and then style of wig.
Sewing in long strips. You sew it onto something in long strips, you mean?
Or you do. On a very thin braid or a very thin... Could overlock it, I suppose.
So you get one long strip with all the hair hanging from it, and then you can put it in zigzags over the head, or you make it into a wig first and then attach it?
You make a little base. You make a little base like that out of fabric. To fit the doll's head.
There isn't a camera on the recorder, so what does it look like?
Okay, it looks like a part of the doll's head.
Okay,
a cap to fit the doll's head.
Okay,
snug.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very snug.
And then you sew the wefted mohair around the cap.
Yeah.
And then you curl the mohair into the style you want it.
So you get miniature curlers.
Yeah, I use drinking straws. You can get them in all different sizes, and you just wet the hair and curl it up and leave it sitting looking lovely for a couple of weeks until you get round to combing it out. And then you can style it however you want. You dye it in all different things. Now, once again, I'm a bit of a purist when it comes to dye, and I use all sorts of dyes from the garden. I use onion skins, and
yes,
I use
lichen. Onion skins, they look brown, but what's the colour it gives you as a dye?
There's red onion skins and brown. Yeah.
Yes.
So
okay.
I made a big mistake once dyeing a whole lot of mohair in red onion skins, and it was the brightest ginger. It was horrible. Mm-hmm. And I dried it all on top of the bonnet of the car. We were down on Foxton Beach on holiday, and a wind got up, and for the next month all over Foxton Beach was this bright red mohair blowing in the sand. That was me that did it. So what else do I use? I use beetroot and of course tea bags.
So beetroot will give you
a pink.
And tea bags will give you
sort of a ochre colour, that colour there. Well, you can't see, but it's a sort of a light blonde, I would say.
Slightly brownish blonde.
Coffee will give you a darker brown.
And these are permanent colours, aren't they?
If you put a little bit of a fixer in the water, like salt or vinegar, it'll fix the colour.
Okay.
But they're never going to be washed. I mean, you know, they're going to stay like that. I mean, we wash the clothes occasionally, but... And people say, how do I clean their faces? Well, that's just like a china cup. You wash a china cup, so you just wash them. I get a cotton bud and some detergent and a warm cup of water and just give them a good, jolly good wash, because the flies do settle on them and the dust settles on them. So that's all you have to do.
Now, the amount of detail in all the painting is really quite phenomenal, and then you fire that in.
Mm-hmm.
Do you then put a sort of protective glaze over that as well? Just leave it?
They never did actually. There was a product came out as a glaze one could put over, which I tried once, and it was horrid. They look like plastic dolls. But one thing I haven't talked about really is the eyes. Now the doll in front of you has got painted eyes. But German dolls quite often had painted eyes, but French dolls nearly always had glass eyes, hand-blown glass eyes, I might add. And the eyes are the soul of the doll. They have to be the right eyes. And German dolls quite often, if they weren't painted, they were sleeping eyes, but the French never did really get into sleeping eyes. They thought it was a little bit of a gimmick, I think.
Yeah. If they did glass eyes, I know there was a sort of doll where if you tilt them back, the eyes closed and you pick
them
up.
That's the sleeping doll. The French dolls were very seldom sleepers.
Okay.
So that's all I can say about eyes, but they have to be the right eyes, and don't they, Barbara?
Yeah. Mm. When you paint the eyes on the doll, she comes alive.
They're the soul of the doll.
The eyes mean a lot. And you can't have them crooked.
They've got to be looking straight at you, really.
Yeah. And you've got on the dresser there, there's a mechanical doll. Now, it's a German doll, is it, with lederhosen?
Yes.
And he plays music.
An
what's
accordion.
He playing?
He's playing an accordion.
And what's the music he's playing?
It's not idle, though. So I have to play it again. This doll's name's Mark. I have a son called Mark. He's the one that plays the bagpipes. It's a German song. Yes, it is. It's Edelweiss, isn't it?
Yeah, Edelweiss. Yes. Edelweiss from The Sound of Music.
Oh.
It's used in The Sound of Music.
No,
And he's got an accordion, and the arms move out and in, and the accordion's playing. And now, you tell me, how did you learn to make dolls with mechanical movement like that?
Well, mostly from my husband, who was a watchmaker.
Mm.
And most of the mechanisms I've got in my mechanical dolls are pretty basic, that I probably could have figured it out, but he was very happy to help me.
Oh, so he sort of put those together for you. You made the doll and he put that.
But there's a few that I've done in dolly workshops, and I've done some with Barbara. Did you do a couple of mechanical dolls with me?
Yes.
The
mandolin player.
Yes. And the waltzing couple.
The waltzing couple.
Cliff was a little bit disappointed that we weren't putting in every part that was handmade, because he was a watchmaker of great renown that used to make his own little wheels and that. And you can buy mechanisms, like clock mechanisms, that just fit in.
Yeah. So now, when you say watchmaker, you mean the old-style mechanical structure?
Yeah, and he was a bit disappointed we weren't doing that I'd just bought bits. But I said, I'm not going to learn how to turn tiny little wheels on a lathe. But no, he thought it was great. He thought, he thought it was really good.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.